Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. Don't forget, you can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your Times radio, on your DAB radio smart speaker. You can download the app. Maybe the app is how you listen to the podcast as well. Or online at times.radio. Right, we've got an extra little bit on the podcast today. You'll be able to hear it later on. I've been speaking to the man who's had Big Ben in his shed. Massively secret operation. Keith Scobie Youngs has been working on the Big Ben clock mechanism in a barn in Cumbria. And nobody knew about it. It was all a top secret. But it's now all back in London, so he's now able to talk about it. So we thought we'd stick that on the end of the podcast as an extra little treat today. Coming up, though, as normal, as it's Wednesday, we've got PMQs unpacked. Tim Shipman and I pause the action from the House of Commons to explain what is going on between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer as they both try to claim the moral high ground on MPs, second jobs and sleaze and all of that. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. No Alice Thompson today. So it's Robert Crampton, joined by Deputy Property Editor of the Times. It's Carol Lewis.
Let's start, first of all, maybe between us we can try and get to the bottom of this. Priti Patel is really cross about the broken asylum system in this country, in part because of the people trying to cross the channel, but in particular because of the Liverpool bomber was a failed asylum seeker. Has anyone got any idea who's been in power for the last 11 years who might be able to shed some light on why the system's broke? Robert, have you got any ideas?
Yeah, I think it's really unfair of her to kind of caricature asylum seekers as a result of the actions of one mentally disturbed individual who, she said he was gaming the system, claiming, you know, converting to Christianity so he couldn't couldn't be sent home because of persecution. I think the asylum system is broken, but not in the way that Priti Patel thinks it is. I think it's broken because it takes too long. Half the appeals are rejected. People sometimes don't get the appeals that they need. It's families being divided. And the asylum system that we claim to be so proud of in this country, which we all hear about, is not really what it once was. We're not the refuge that we claim to be, and I think in that respect it is broken, and it's a bureaucratic nightmare. You can't claim asylum in another country, but you can't arrive here. Let me get this right. You can't travel here legally to claim asylum, so therefore people get on boats and then they try to claim it when they get here. It seems to me that it needs reform, but probably not in the way that Priti thinks it does.
But even in, actually, this is so often the case with Priti Patel, even on her own terms, you know, for 2 years now, she's been saying, I'm going to do something about people coming across the channel on small boats. And it's got worse. It's got worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
So even on her own terms, if she thinks there is a particular problem with this guy in Liverpool, then, and he was repeatedly failed, well, DePaul to do something. It's not like you're just an innocent bystander in all of this.
Quite, yeah. And some of the schemes that she's come up with over the in the summer, she came up with putting people on oil rigs.
Disused ferries.
Yeah. And so,
Ascension Islands, blaming TikTok.
That's right. It doesn't inspire that much confidence in, given that she is running the system.
Yeah. What do you think, Carol?
I don't know why she doesn't make better use of the International Resettlement Scheme, which is a more organised scheme that you do from the country of origin. So that would dissuade the people smugglers and have fewer people just turning up and trying their luck. And they'd be supported. Because I think one of the main things is there's lots of individual direct applicants and they're not being supported. They're sort of like this poor guy, who I think actually this case is more a breakdown in the mental health system as much as the asylum system.
Quite.
I think there should be a better system for them. And as Bob says, we've got a huge backlog. There's something like 70,000 people in the backlog. I mean, that needs to be cleared swiftly, and they need to have proper, fair representation. And we do need to, if they fail and fail more than twice, then be deported. We have to be sort of firm and fair.
And it suits Priti Patel politically to make out like we're being swamped with asylum seekers.
Yeah.
I think if you look at us compared to other European Union countries, not that we're in the European Union anymore.
What? Nobody's told me about this.
We rank, in terms of applications per capita, we rank 14th.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the middle ranking in terms of, it's not as if the word is there on the street in Damascus, you must get yourself to Calais and get in a boat and everything will be fine and you'll be able to stay, claim benefits and all the rest of it, which is kind of what she's implying by saying this under result, the actions of one disturbed individual.
I'm interested in sort of the politics of this as well, Carol. It's just the ongoing ability of Boris Johnson in particular and this government in general to pretend that they haven't been in government for 11 years.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Daniel Finkelstein wrote a very good piece today about how Boris shouldn't apologise because political apologies don't work. I think basically no one would believe Boris if he did apologise just because he's Boris.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at the sleaze thing. I mean, he's pinging back and forth. He's saying one thing to fortnight ago, and now he's just gone to the other extreme.
But it's amazing that somehow the Labour Party haven't managed to point out the Conservatives have been in government for 11 years. And actually, unlike Boris Johnson, who's been in and out a bit, Priti Patel has been in the government apart from when she had to resign for a slightly peculiar holiday to Israel.
Oh, when she was making up foreign policy. Yeah.
Yes, when she was. We've all done it.
Of course. You have a few drinks,
and before you know it, you're sitting down with Benjamin Netanyahu over some prawns. She's been in the government the whole time. She's been, you know, junior minister, cabinet minister, but for her to, and also I suppose actually she's the Home Secretary. You know, the security services only have to be, you know, have to be lucky every time, and a terrorist only has to be lucky once. But you know, somewhere along the line, there has possibly been a failure of policing, security, whatever. And actually, her saying, "Well, it's the asylum system's fault," rather than a failure of, you know, the state to protect us.
And also, I was going to say a rude word then, but stuff happens. Stuff happens, and it's a globalized world, and people who weren't necessarily coming to this country with certain belief systems now do, and bad things happen. I think the security service has actually done an amazing job in terms of the lack of. Incidents that we've had since 7/7, but no, I wouldn't. Sometimes there is you can't necessarily point a finger say this is this.
But also, I suppose there's an interesting question on the sort of the politics of how, if Priti Patel keeps saying the asylum system is broken, can she still be saying that into the next election? Or
I wouldn't have thought so. And they come up with some proposals to reform it, haven't they? Earlier this month. I think so. Presumably, she's saying we've got.
Yeah, but then at some point she has to start saying the asylum system's brilliant.
Yes,
before the next election.
Yeah.
Well, let's move because you slightly touched on sleaze. I think both of you did actually. Do you agree with Danny then, Carol, that Boris Johnson apologising would be a mistake. I dug it up a couple of days ago. There was this great last year when he's been asked to apologise for his handling of the pandemic. And why wouldn't he apologise? He said, "I'm sorry if I don't apologise often enough."
Sounds so much like Boris, doesn't it?
And even that wasn't an apology, because it was if. He didn't say, "I'm sorry for not saying sorry. I'm sorry if I don't say sorry," without ever really accepting that he didn't. But it's just quite interesting. Your sort of take on it is to the politics of apologies and U-turns and that sort of thing.
Yes, only Danny's argument was that political apologies don't work because they draw attention more to the problem. I think what I would add in there is it doesn't matter even if they did work, we wouldn't believe Boris and his crew now. I think it's gone past that point. We don't think he's sincere.
And I suppose instead of getting yourself, in Boris's case, instead of apologising for the last 2 weeks, it might have been better if he just hadn't made a hash of it a fortnight ago.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I think we're probably cynical about apology. I think there probably was a time, maybe 20, 30 years ago, when a politician could get some traction and get some impact with an apology. But now everybody apologises for everything.
Yeah.
So
we went through a spate. It hasn't happened for a while. We went through a spate of prime ministers apologising for things that happened 100 or 200 or 300 years ago.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, didn't Blair apologise for the potato famine, didn't he?
Possibly. Gordon Brown apologised for sending people to Australia.
Because they were nicking food because of the famine. Yeah. So they got transported, yeah. Yeah, I mean, fair enough. It was a bad, you know, it was bad. But I think people, I think people just discount them now.
Mm. And what about having you on, Carol, as the deputy property editor? What's going on in your patch? Because every time we've spoken before, the housing market seems to bear no relation to reality. Is it still booming, or is it? Well, now the economy's picking up. Is it now crack? What's going on in property?
It started to slow slightly because everyone thought the Bank of England was going to raise interest rates. And then they fooled us all by not doing it. But the banks had gone off already and started cutting their deals. So that has taken the wind out the sails a little. But having said that, it's still going, you know, fairly strong. It hasn't crashed. And I don't think it is going to crash. If the bank starts putting up the interest rates, we could see it flatline. And maybe next year dip by a couple of percent. But not fall substantially.
It's. I mean, I suppose the fact that we've got these figures of inflation up to about 4.2% suggests that probably an interest rate rise is coming.
I think it will do, yes. If not December, then early next year. It'd be a bit cruel to do it in December, I think, just before Christmas.
And what about the changing way we're living? Everyone was going to move to the countryside and do everything from Zoom. Is that still the case? Where are people buying houses? Is it big detached houses in the country, or are people going back to flats in cities?
It's swung back a bit, and now we're all being called back in the office. there's been a lot of renting apartments in the city centre, and those have got the money left over from their country house sale looking for pied a terres. I think, yes, realism has hit home now.
about a year ago, Carol sent me to Barnard Castle to report on that trend. Mm. I can't think why we picked Barnard Castle. It's a mystery.
Very good opticians.
Yeah, they're good opticians.
Yeah, very good opticians.
And the problem there was that they can't build the houses because of NIMBYism.
Yeah.
You know, if people want to move there, of course they do. It's lovely, but it's a shortage of supply. Yeah. And that's why they were trying to change the planning, and that died a death at the Amersham by-election, didn't it?
Yeah, and so there was a U-turn on that.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah. There's a massive NIMBYism problem. I know that Matt, we talked on this show before about the problems in Devon and Cornwall, where they are angry that second homeowners are angry that there's not enough homes being built for local people, and then almost every development that tries to get through, even though it has high quota of affordable homes, everyone says, well, not in my village, you'll spoil it.
And so the problem perpetuates. Now, Robert, I need to speak to you because you've been to see a famous property of a different kind.
I went to Pinewood Studios yesterday, which is for the first time, which is good. And I've been interviewing famous people for 30 years. I'm surprised by it. But what really amazed me, well, it just kind of moved me, actually, was the place where I did the interview. I was interviewing a guy who's got a gym there, trains these stars. was the dressing room for the Carry On films.
Amazing. Amazing.
And I just
costumes in there, sort of heavy nurse's outfit.
No, it's really quite, it's quite poignant because it's sort of semi-derelict.
Oh, wow.
And there's an old bar where they used to have a pre-take drink. Then there's the dressing room with a sort of kind of Roman theme and various sketches on the wall of Hattie Jakes and Sid James. And then there's the where the gym is a boarded over swimming pool where they used to have a swim.
Wow.
I felt I was really, I was touching British cultural history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And I was, and the next door was the James Bond soundstage. So I had the works.
Amazing. That sound, now, Carol, if Robert Rogers gets hands on that and turned that into a house, that sounds like something that's going to be worth a lot of money.
Oh my gosh. Yes, definitely. That would be front cover. On
the property. They're refurbing it. I'm like, maybe, yeah. It's right in the middle of Pinewood Studios. I don't think it's residential.
You don't want the ghost of Sid James going up goosing you in the middle of the night.
No. Oh, I think saucy.
I think I've talked about this before, but my 18th
You're
birthday
18.
Was a Carry On film themed
fantastic
fancy dress.
Mine was a James Bond.
You see, you're obviously cooler than me. Yeah. There's me dressed up as Kenneth Williams.
Yeah, and I'm bad James Bond, I think. I was George Lazenby James Bond.
Oh, dear.
What are you, Carol, are you more Carry On or more James Bond?
I think I'd like to think I was more James Bond, to be honest. I don't want to be Hattie Jakes.
No, Jones, or Joan Sims. What about Babs Windsor, though?
Oh, yes, I can pull a pint.
Carol Lewis and Robert Crampton there, and of course you can read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is PMQ's Unpacked.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
Yes, here we are again. It's that time of the week. Tim Shipman, the chief political commentator of the Sunday Times, is here. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
What do you think Keir Starmer might want to ask Boris Johnson about today?
I'm going to give you the whole of PMQs. Keir Starmer's going to say, "You caved in on sleaze because of me." And Boris Johnson's going to reply, "But my stuff goes further than yours." And Keir Starmer's going to say, "But it's very non-specific and the devil's in the detail and you won't tell us the detail." And in half an hour's time...
we will be proved right. Does it matter politically? Has Boris Johnson taken the sting out of Keir Starmer's attack? Or can Keir Starmer take some credit for bouncing Boris Johnson into it?
He can certainly try to take some credit, and he probably is due some credit, but it's always slightly less charged when the bloke's already caved in. What Starmer should probably try to do is seek some divisions between Boris Johnson and the people sitting behind him, who are none too happy about Boris Johnson, you know, caving into the left. There was a great quote in one of the papers this morning that said, "He's gone from circling the wagons to throwing us to the Indians."
Wowzers. And actually, it's not just that there's divisions between Boris Johnson and those behind him. There's divisions amongst those behind him, too.
Exactly, yes. So all the sort of 2019 intake, the 2017 intake, the newer MPs, particularly those in the north, for whom an MP's salary of 82 grand is considered a pretty princely sum. And then a lot of the old guard, the people who tried to get Boris Johnson to back Aaron Paterson, to change the rules, to stitch it all up. Some of those, of course, on the list of 30 MPs with lobbying interests outside Parliament. And they are used to topping up their salary. Their ministerial days are over for most part. And there's a real sort of cultural divide in the Conservative Party. So if Starmer's got any sense, he will try and wiggle his fingers in these open sores on the Tory benches.
And I suppose the other thing is that if you're a new MP in a marginal seat, you probably consider being an MP a full-time job. Whereas if you're an old MP in a safe Tory seat, you probably do have a bit more time around the edges to do some extra work.
Exactly. You know, these new MPs show every sign of wanting to represent their constituents rather than climb the greasy pole. Some of them are surprised to be there at all. A lot of them are earning more money than when they were in jobs before Parliament. And they don't buy this argument that 82 grand isn't enough.
OK, then, brace yourselves. It's likely to be a lively one, this, I think. Let's kick off, then. It's PMQ's Unpacked. We pause the action live from the House of Commons. This is question number one from Keir Starmer.
The leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer.
Yeah! Thank you, Mr Speaker. Trust matters. And after the last fortnight, the Prime Minister's got a lot of work to do. A central plank in this government's promise to the north of England is a Crossrail of the North with at least an entirely new high-speed rail line between Manchester and Leeds. A Crossrail for the North, an entirely new line. That is the promise. It's already been made. So I don't want the Prime Minister fobbing off the House about waiting till tomorrow. He can say today, will he stick by that promise? Yes or no?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
He should wait and see what is going to be announced tomorrow, because we will announce, we will produce a fantastic integrated rail plan. I'm not going to spoil it for them, Mr. Speaker. Why would I? We're going to produce a fantastic...
Oh, don't. I expect the front bench to behave better than what it is doing at the moment. If you don't want to listen to the answer, let me know now. I do, and I cannot hear when you all shout together.
That's Lindsay Hoyle ticking off the Labour front bench.
I expect better politics from both sides. Let's show a little bit more decorum than we're seeing at the moment. Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, when we produce our integrated rail plan tomorrow, people across the House and across the country will see what we are doing to cut journey times, to make life easier and better for people in the North East, in the North West, in the Midlands, across the whole of the north of the country. And, Mr Speaker, we're the biggest programme of investment in rail for a century, Mr Speaker, for a century. And what we are doing, Mr Speaker, is we are giving people in those communities the same access to commuter-type services that people in the southeast of this country have felt entitled to for more than a century. And that is going to be levelling up across the whole of the UK, Mr Speaker.
OK, let's jump in there. Boris Johnson sounding a bit croaky and also slightly wrong-footed that Keir Starmer is asking about...
Well, nearly as wrong-footed as us, in fact.
Shh. We'll take all that out of the
air. Drawing a discreet veil over that. Yes, so he's a bit croaky. I think he made a comment yesterday about how his boy Wilfred has gone into the... into nursery, and that does tend to lead to a series of germs taking themselves home, and he's got a bit of he's a bit under the weather, I think.
I thought that, Keir Starmer kicked off by saying trust matters, and I suspect what we're going to see is him sort of building an argument on, rather than just the Westminster village story about MPs and second jobs, actually, if you're living in the north, you were told there were going to be some new rail lines, you thought, well, I like the sound of that, I'm going to vote for that, and now you're about to find out you're not going to get it.
Yeah, and this is a classic case of government sort of pre-briefing stuff and leaks happening and ruining announcements. And, you know, what's caught the attention out of this integrated rail plan, which is launched tomorrow, is that the eastern branch of HS2 is being scrapped, and it doesn't sound like the big east-west sort of Crossrail line is going to happen in quite the form that they said. Now, if you talk to people in government, they will tell you actually what's going to happen is that the vast majority of people are going to benefit from shorter commuting times. As a figure that came up in Cabinet last week, where apparently pretty well two-thirds of people in Europe have a 30-minute commute, and it's about one-third of people in the north of England, and they want to sort of level that up, to coin a phrase. But, you know, what are people focused on, including those Red Wall MPs we were talking about on his own benches? It looks like a broken promise. And they've not got ahead of it. They've not sort of announced the good news first. It's the bad news that's dribbling out. And, you know, their argument about commuter times and it all being wonderful and 10 billion quid being spent is going to have to wait for tomorrow. So he's on the back foot.
And presumably the tactic of doing it on a Thursday is you put it beyond PMQs, so you haven't got the details. So you do it at the end of the week and then everyone leaves. The trouble with that is if it leaks to the Sunday papers, you then have this four-day window of nothing.
Wait till Thursday.
Wait till Thursday. And, the scrapping of the HS2, the eastern leg of HS2 between the Midlands and Leeds could make journeys longer by 20 minutes. It's quite a long time if that is your commute. Well, let's go back. Boris Johnson really seems to have an answer, except wait for tomorrow. So let's see what Keir Starmer does with question number two.
Keir Starmer.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that was a lot of words. but it wasn't a yes. So that's one important promise to the North that he won't stand by. Let's look at another. In February this year, the Prime Minister told this House, I can certainly confirm that we are going to develop the eastern leg as well as the whole of HS2. Yeah. The whole of HS2. A new high-speed line running continuously, no gaps, between Birmingham and Leeds. So will the Prime Minister confirm that he stands by that promise?
Prime Minister!
I'm afraid the Right Honourable Gentleman is in danger of getting hoist on his own petard, Mr. Speaker. He needs to wait and see what we announce tomorrow, because I think he will find that the people of the North East, of the North West, the people of Leeds, the people of Nottingham, the people of Sheffield, and the people of the whole of the North West and the North East of this country will benefit massively.
Any other northern towns and cities to announce?
Keir Starmer.
I think we'll just carry on, Keir Starmer. Let him ask another go.
Speaker, a lot of words, but not a yes. So that's two important promises to the North that he won't stand by. No wonder trust in the Prime Minister is at an all-time low. Across the country and belatedly across this House, there is now agreement that Owen Paterson broke the rules and that the government should not have tried to let him off the hook. Many members opposite have apologised. The Business Secretary has apologised for his part. The Leader of the House has apologised for his part. But they were following the Prime Minister's lead. So will he do the decent thing and just say sorry for trying to give the green light to corruption?
OK, let's just jump in there. So just to give the background to that. The Business Secretary is Kwasi Kwarteng, who called for the Standards Commissioner, Catherine Stone, to consider her position, something he's now apologised for. The Leader of the House is Jacob Rees-Mogg, who on his own podcast admitted he'd made a bit of a hash of things, and it was probably a mistake to try and overturn Owen Paterson's punishment. I don't know if you are. I think you are a betting man, Tim. How much did you bet on Boris Johnson now standing up and apologising?
I think it's fairly low, by which you would get decent odds. He did an appearance in a sort of what was supposed to be in a way day that ended up being in Downing Street last week, and he admitted it was an unforced error in front of his ministers, which they took to be an admission of guilt. But he didn't quite apologise. I understand he is feels bad about the position he put some of his staff in, but he's not someone who makes public apologies very often. It's just not his style. He thinks that if you apologise for anything, you open the door to apologising for everything. And he just thinks that's a bad look politically.
Well, let's see how he does respond then to Keir Starmer's suggestion that he might like to apologise.
Mr. Speaker, yeah, well, yes, as I've said before, it certainly was a mistake to conflate the case of an individual member, no matter how sad, with the point of principle at stake. And we do need a cross-party approach on an appeals process. We also need, Mr. Speaker, a cross-party approach on the way forward. And that's why we've tabled the proposals that we have to take forward the report of the Independent Committee for Standards in Public Life of 2018 with those two key principles that everybody in this House should focus primarily and above all on their job here in this House, and secondly, that no one should exploit their position in order to advance the commercial interests of anybody else. That's our position, Mr. Speaker. We want to take forward those reforms. In the meantime, perhaps he could clear up from his proposals, whether he would continue to be able to take money as he did from Mishcon Dorea and other legal firms.
Let's hear Lindsay Hoyle.
Prime Minister, as you know, and I do remind you, it's Prime Minister's questions, not Leader of the Opposition's questions.
Well, there we are. It's notable, Tim Shipman, that the House of Commons chamber, particularly on the Tory side, is not exactly packed to the rafters.
No, and normally this is sort of opportunity to turn up and show your support and make as much noise as possible, and it's odd, to say the least.
Harry Cole from The Sun, I think, is in the press gallery. He can spot at least 30 empty seats, which actually probably means, by the way, you probably fit 60 people in there,
they have to squeeze in
at PMQs. Yeah. And there's quite a lot of green, which doesn't, it's not a ringing endorsement of the Prime Minister today.
No, it certainly isn't. And I can't really ever recall it in non-COVID sort of concerned times ever being anything other than packed to the rafters with people standing in the corridors and up by the doors.
And this defence of, well, you know, Keir Starmer was at it as well, taking money from a legal firm. Does that really work? I suppose it just, in the end, it just makes everyone dislike all politicians.
Yeah, I think it works in the, to the degree that you look at a lot of polling, and I did a focus group last Thursday evening, and there's certainly a sense, yes, the Tories might be worse affected by this, but but you ask people, and you know, the biggest response is they're both as bad as each other, and in a sense, that's the best sort of hope for the Tories to drag Labour into it as well. And there are some questions about what Starmer's been doing. He appeared to be trying to get an extra job with a law firm after Labour themselves had said they would ban such things, and he's got a load of payments that he's never acknowledged where they came from.
And, you know, and we've even seen, you know, Ed Davey, the Lib Dem leader, last week was defending his position, and now he's, I think, said he's going to give up the consultancy work that he was doing.
Yeah, I think with him, he has always claimed that that money goes into a trust for his disabled son to sort of look after him after they've gone. But yeah, for the public, on the face of it, it's still the same process, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still the same. But it goes back to, you know, you can't, as Boris Johnson admitted there with the Owen Paterson case, you can't make exceptions just because the particular situation is sad. Well, let's go back to the House of Commons as well. Question number four.
Keir Starmer.
That's not an apology. Everybody else has apologised for him, but he won't apologise for himself. A coward, not a leader. Weeks defending corruption. Yesterday, a screeching last-minute U-turn to avoid defeat on Labour's plan to ban MPs from dodgy second contracts. But waving one white flag won't be enough to restore trust. And there are plenty of opposition days to come. And we will not let the Prime Minister water down the proposals or pretend that it's job done. We still haven't shut the door on the revolving door where ministers are regulating a company one minute and working for them the next. There are plenty of cases that still stain this House. There are two simple steps to sorting it out. Proper independence and powers for the Business Appointments Committee and banning these job swaps. Will the Prime Minister take those steps?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've called, as you know, and indeed you have called, Mr. Speaker, for a cross-party approach to this. And what I think we need, what I think we need to do is to work together on the basis of the independent report by the Committee of Standards in Public Life to take things forward and indeed to address the appeals process. But what I think everybody can see, Mr. Speaker, is that in a classic, lawyerly way, the Right Honourable Gentleman is now trying to prosecute others for exactly the course of action that he took himself. What I think the nation wants to know, because his register is incomplete, who paid Mishcon Dorea and who paid the 25,000? Who's paying him for his...
Just a minute. Prime Minister, Prime Minister, I don't want to fall out about it. I've made it very clear. It is Prime Minister's questions. It's not for the opposition to answer your question. Whether we like it or not, those are the rules of the game that we're all into, and we play by the rules, don't we? And we respect this house, so let's respect the house. Keir Starmer.
There we are. Another tip. We play by the rules, don't we?
The Speaker doing satire now.
let's start at the beginning there with Keir Starmer. A coward, not a leader. That's clearly the soundbite that he wanted, which he then followed up with weeks of not dealing with corruption, which is, do you think that was that an accidental or deliberate echo of Tony
week,
Blair?
Week, yeah, which Blair said about John Major, I think, yeah. Didn't he? There's something slightly tinny about Starmer sort of hurling around insults. It doesn't feel natural for him. But, you know, that's a line. I'm not sure it's a particularly effective line, given that he's trying to paint Boris Johnson as a sort of handmaid of corruption, and then he's calling him a coward. I mean, it doesn't quite work.
Is that because
you
can't say cook in the House of Commons?
That may be.
Maybe they've been through a whole list of words beginning with C. And coward was the one they thought they could get away with.
And then Johnson hits back with his, you know, this is a classic lawyerly response, and obviously comes up in Tory, you know, polling that Starmer's a sort
it's
of.
Bit, it's all a bit last summer of last year, isn't it?
It does have a slight.
And actually, crucially, I mean, because he's not allowed to answer the question, in Keir Starmer's defense, he didn't actually do it, did he? He was having conversations about taking a job.
Yeah, that's right. And he then ended up not taking the job. There's a dispute over whether he didn't do it because Jeremy Corbyn told him not to, or whether he decided himself not to. The one sort of outstanding thing with Starmer is that there's a decent sum of money that he's claimed for giving legal advice, and we don't know who he was giving that legal advice to. It wasn't Mishcon de Rea, which is the law firm that Boris Johnson's talking about. The Labour Party say that's for reasons of client confidentiality.
Well, let's have another go then. This is Keir Starmer. Question number 5 on PMQ's Unpacked.
Mr Speaker, that newfound commitment to upholding standards didn't last long. Mr Speaker, here's the difference. When somebody in my party misbehaves, I kick them out. Yeah!
He's obviously referring to Jeremy Corbyn there.
Where's Rob Roberts? Mr. Pratt. And I don't think. Look, this is not good. We lost a dear friend. I want to show that this House has learnt from it. I don't want each other to be shouted down. I want questions to be respected. I expect the public to actually be able to hear the questions and the answers, because I'm struggling in this chair. I need no more. Keir Starmer.
Mr Speaker, when somebody in my party misbehaves, I kick them out. Yeah. When somebody in his party misbehaves, he tries to get them off the hook. Yeah. I lead, he covers up. Yeah. Let's try another issue. We know that Owen Paterson was a paid lobbyist for Randox. We know that he sat in on a call between Randox and the minister responsible for handling health contracts. We know that Randox has been awarded government contracts worth almost £600 million without competition or tender. Against that backdrop, the public are concerned that taxpayers' money may have been influenced by paid lobbying. There's only one way to get to the bottom of this. A full, transparent investigation. If he votes for Labour's motion this afternoon, that investigation can start. Will he vote for it, or will he vote for another cover-up?
Prime Minister!
I'm very happy to publish all the details of the Randox contracts, which have been investigated by the National Audit Office already. We're talking of cover-ups. I'm sorry, Mr Speaker, but we still have not heard why the Honourable General will not tell...
Prime Minister, I'm not going to be challenged. You may be the Prime Minister of this country, but in this House, I'm in charge, and we're going to carry on. End of that.
Wowzers.
Well, I mean, even John Bercow often didn't quite go that far.
I'm the King is quite a...
And actually, I think that was interesting because in the previous one, Johnson was trying to ask Starmer questions about it. In that, he was simply making a statement about it. Yeah. And I think there's probably a material difference there.
He might have got away with it if it was the other way around.
If he'd stated it previously, he probably would have got away with it.
This, that, and the other.
But having been told off once, he's now been properly slapped down. You'd have to say Lindsay Hoyle's keeping him in line a little bit better than Keir Starmer today.
It also, because at various times the relationship between Lindsay Hoyle and Number 10 has been up and down. I think it's fair to say it's not in a good place right now, not least because, you know, Lindsay Hoyle is particularly furious about this mess over the Standards Commissioner, the Owen Paterson case, the, you know, try to rewrite, essentially the government trying to rewrite the rules of the House of Commons without consulting the House of Commons.
Yes.
And getting cross-party consensus. That's the sort of thing that gets him very...
Yeah, and he was put in, you know, but with a fair number of Tory votes who didn't like what John Bercow got up to during the Brexit battles. And, you know, they'll be a little bit dismayed that Lindsay Hoyle is showing quite such a degree of spine. But he's certainly someone who's got views and he's not frightened to let people know what they are.
And on Keir Starmer, if we weren't sure if weeks was a deliberate Blair echo, we then got I lead my party, he covers up, which was also...
Yeah, Blair said I lead my party, he follows his. So there's a sort of...
Somebody's been watching the Blair Brown documentary, I think
they might have been.
And it's, they've absorbed it slightly.
This is like geek jazz, isn't it? You know, political
stuff. I mean, the interesting thing is, although the Labour Party really cheered when Lindsay Hoyle ticked Boris Johnson off, in terms of Keir Starmer trying to land his key message... He got interrupted, didn't he?
So he had to sort of redo it. I felt that when Starmer was landing what he felt were big, heavy blows, he wasn't getting that much sort of cheering.
When somebody in my party misbehaves, I kick them out. That got a big cheer. And then
Lindsay Hoyle get to the payoff.
Yeah, then Lindsay Hoyle interrupted. So for the purposes of his TV clip, he then had to repeat it, and the Labour lot forgot to cheer the second time. When somebody in my party misbehaves, I kick them out. He tries to get them off the hook.
There was one tiny bit of news in there. There wasn't. Boris Johnson said he was prepared to publish the details of the Randox deal. They'll now be trying to hold him to that in the days ahead, I suspect.
And, well, as we know, Boris Johnson's a man of his word, so that will definitely happen. Let's go back to the House of Commons. Keir Starmer, question number six.
Mr. Speaker, I think the Prime Minister just said he's happy to publish all the Randox papers in relation to these contracts. So we'll take that and we'll pursue it. And I remind the Prime Minister, when I was Director of Public Prosecutions, I prosecuted MPs who broke the rule. He has been investigated by every organisation he's ever been elected to. That's the difference. Billions of pounds of taxpayers' money handed to their mates and donors. Tory MPs getting rich by working as lobbyists, one not even bothering to turn up because he's in the Caribbean advising tax havens. And the Prime Minister somehow expects us to believe that he's the man to clean up Westminster. He led his troops through the sewers to cover up corruption, and he can't even say sorry. The truth is that beneath the bluster, he still thinks it's one rule for him and another for his mates. At the same time as his government are engulfed in sleaze, they're rowing back on the promises they made to the North. And it's working people who are paying the price. Is it any wonder that people are beginning to think that the joke isn't funny anymore?
Mr. Speaker, it is plain from listening to the right honourable gentleman that he seeks to criticise this government while refusing to explain his own position. And you've ruled on that, Mr. Speaker. You've ruled on that, Mr. Speaker. I hear you. But his own misconduct, Mr. Speaker, is absolutely clear to everybody.
That's pretty niche.
Is absolutely clear. And meantime, Mr. Speaker, we will get on. On a cross-party basis, with taking forward the business that I've outlined, and we will get on with the business of this government, which is leading the country out of the pandemic.
Prime Minister, just, I'm struggling to hear, and if it's correct what I've said, it was about Leader of the Opposition and misconduct. We can't or cannot accuse someone of misconduct. Now, I may, and I'm... Just before the Leader of the House gives me an answer, all I'm trying to say, I cannot hear. If it was said, I want it withdrawn. If it wasn't, I will accept it. I'm just a moment.
We're now having a row about a pun.
Prime Minister,
Speaker, I refer to the Right Honourable Gentleman's misconduct. Because that is what he's guilty of. that is what he's guilty of.
Lindsay Hoyle is now taking the advice of the clerks as to whether or not that is in order.
I don't think this has done this House any good today. I'll be quite honest, I think it's been ill-tempered. I think it shows the public that this House has not learned from the other week. I need this House to gain respect, but it starts by individuals showing respect to each other. Right, let's go.
Blimey. So, I mean, I'd say the person who's had the best morning is probably Lindsay Hoyle.
I think he's probably edged it, hasn't he? I mean, Starmer finished quite well there. There was quite a good sort of peroration, wasn't there? And saying the joke's not funny anymore is certainly something that comes out in some of the focus groups I've been listening to, that people who hoped Boris Johnson would sort of deliver for them and thinking he still kept up his comedy act. And then, of course, bravura of the man to then reply with a pun, which he then had to explain and stick to, and it was nearly the subject of a ruling. So, not the most edifying display.
No,
I just wonder whether Starmer would have been better carrying on where he started off. And if you're all about winning back these seats in the North, I mean, just hammer him on, you know, everything, you know.
And actually, there was a really successful PMQs actually might have been to have done trains for question number one, you know, worked your way through a series of broken policy promises,
yeah.
Wind up with sleaze so he can't get to it until later, and then sort of hammer him at the end. Ian Dale, no fan former Conservative candidate, obviously he's now, I think he's on another radio station if it's still going. He's just tweeted, said, I've no hesitation saying that Boris Johnson's performance in the House today at PMQs was a disgrace. But it wasn't particularly edifying, was it? At a time when he doesn't really do sort of statesman-like rising above it, admitting that things have gone wrong, and he's determined.
No, his instinct always is to fight and drag the other person into a sort of close clinch, and you know, it's like the boxer who stops the other fella boxing by just sort of grabbing him by the neck and holding him tight. And you know, it was a fairly unedifying display. You know, Starmer certainly had the better of the big two. But I wonder whether Lindsay Hoyle sort of saying, we play by the rules, don't we? Was mocking Boris Johnson a little bit.
It might, yes.
The most effective line of the lot.
So that was PMQ's Unpacked with Tim Shipman. And we thought we'd just sneak a little extra nugget on the end of the podcast today, just because we had a really nice chat on the radio show today with Keith Scobie-Youngs, the man who's had Big Ben in his shed. Yeah, it's been a while since we've heard the famous Big Ben chimes as the restoration project continues. Well, the Cumbria Clock Company have been ticking along and restoring the big clock for the last 3 years. But it's all been happening in secret. We're here to lift the lid on this. It's almost worthy of a Bond film, this. Keith Scobie-Youngs is the joint founder of the Cumbria Clock Company. They work on some of the biggest church and public clocks in the UK. They don't get much bigger than the clock from the Elizabeth Tower in Parliament. Hi, Keith.
Hi there.
So, I mean, this is quite an undertaking, isn't it? Explain just the significance of the clock, the mechanism. How big a job is it? And then we'll come on to how you've been doing this secretly.
Well, I mean, it's a hard thing to kind of put into kind of anything. I mean, if you think the Big Ben is the world's most famous public clock, I mean, it was put into the tower in 1859. It's 11 and a half tons of mechanism. I mean, it was a precision instrument. It had to keep within 1 second of the first blow of the hour, and it had to strike a bell in the original specification, which was 15 tons. We ended up with a 13 and a half ton bell. I mean, at that time, nothing like this had been done. And for me, I've always been a clockmaker. I've always wanted to be a clockmaker from the age of 14. I studied at Birmingham. I ended up in London as a turret clockmaker, and I was fortunate to work with some of those engineers who rebuilt the clock in the 1970s after the big disaster then. And even though they used to tell me these stories, I never thought I would end up in a position of doing the biggest renovation conservation project to the world's most famous clock ever. And so to end up doing so, you kind of have to give yourself a pinch. I'm a very lucky man, and something I've always wanted to do, I've reached the pinnacle of my career, I suppose you could say.
And how does this compare to, I mean, what's the biggest clock you've worked on before this one? Are we talking sort of normally mantelpiece, grandfather, church? How big do you go normally?
We just do, I've always done just church and public clocks since leaving Birmingham Polytechnic 40 years ago. So, I mean, we are responsible for some beautiful and massive clocks. You know, we do Manchester Town Hall. We're in doing a massive restoration project there, which we're very proud of. We looked after the clock for 25 years. It's iconic. It's wonderful. We do the Royal Liver Building, which actually have larger dials than Big Ben. They're the biggest dials in the country at 24 feet. And we're proud to look after that for the City of Liverpool. But I think everybody has to agree, Big Ben, from, you know, sounding out across the world and being on a sauce bottle for all these years, you know, just makes it special.
And so talk me through the process of then. Presumably there are lots of pieces and they all need to be carefully taken apart. How do you make sure that when you take them all down in London and then take them to your secret location in the Lake District? I mean, we've all had the, you know, when you pop the back off a watch and everything. Well, I used to work in 8 Samuel and it used to happen to me all the time. Pop the back off a watch, springs ping everywhere. And how do you make sure you know, you've got that on such a massive scale. How do you make sure that you've got all the pieces, when you take it all apart, you can put it all back together again when you get it back to your workshop?
Well, I work with some very experienced people. We're working with the Palace Clock team, who know the clock well. I also had an experienced team from the Cumbria Clock Company. So we know our processes. We photograph everything. We take sketches. We take things apart. We put them into bags. We put the bags into boxes and we label the boxes. We label all the parts and we slowly just kind of tape them down. You know, you've got to realise with a clock, especially this clock, you don't want any spare parts. There won't be any spare parts in the project, I can promise you. And so, you know, again, we're an experienced team. I have some excellent members of staff here who know what to do. And when we're doing a little parish church, we do the same process. And so, you know, we just continued that with the Great Clock of Westminster.
And is it very fiddly, or are because it's such a big clock, does that mean all the pieces are big, or are there still somewhere at the heart of it a tiny little fiddly bit that really needs to be very precise, or is it all scaled up?
Well, you go from the quarter chime barrel, which is the largest component in horology in Britain, at least, and that weighs 860 kilos, and that's the part which plays the Westminster chimes, down to the gravity legs on the, you know, Lord Grimthorpe's double three gravity escapement, which made the clock so accurate. It was the first clock which used this escapement. And you've got a component there which most likely weighs, you know, I don't know, 25 grams, you know, something like that, or 250, a small amount in comparison to the barrel. And so, you know, you have to treat it in the same way you would a watch when you're working at 8 Samuels. You know, you wouldn't take a back off a watch, put it on your kitchen table and decorate your kitchen, would you? And so with a great clock like this, you had to take it out of the site. And it's been a very challenging site for everybody involved, from the main contractors all the way to the stonemasons. It's a very small footprint. And, you know, it's meant a lot of teamwork and a lot of effort and everybody working together. And the last thing they wanted was 11 and a half tonnes of precision instrument in their tower.
And it's, like you said, it's a very old clock. Is there an instruction manual that when you come to do the work and you think, oh, OK, we'll just open up the instruction manual, it'll tell us everything? Or are you sort of going in blind a bit?
Well, it's interesting, really. I mean, the clock was designed by Edmund Denison, who became Lord Grimthorpe, and he wrote a book called Watch, Clocks and Bells. And in there, he discusses his clock, the Great Clock of Westminster. And so we're in a very unique position where we do have the manufacturer's inner thoughts on his design process. And in there, on the front piece, was a folding drawing of the clock mechanism. Now, that was the only drawing we knew of. What was nice is having his thoughts, his descriptions of why he did things, which made the project unique. We have, since with having the clock in the workshops here, made a full set of drawings, and we will produce a manual for looking after the clock so that for the future generations, they will have a bit more of an insight on how the clock is dismantled, how you look after it and where to lubricate it. So, you know, everybody involved in that will be able to kind of look after it for future generations, which is great.
Now, we should discuss the fact you've been doing all this in a secret location. So you yes. take it all down out of central London and recreate, yeah. sort of clean it all up, recreate it, put it back together again in your workshop at the Cumbria Clock Company. How, and obviously, yeah. I mean, I don't know, presumably if somebody stole it, it'd be quite a difficult thing to sell, you know, pop it on eBay, I've got the Big Ben clock mechanism. But security is presumably a big issue. And the sort of the village came together to sort of keep it safe.
Yeah, I think what you've got to realise is if people know you've got the world's most famous clock here, then it becomes a target. I think it would have been a target if people knew. You'd have the enthusiasts always knocking on your door wanting to have a look at it. It'd become a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
There would be people who would want to steal parts as mementos. There's no doubt about that. It was very important that we kept it quiet. And really, the village of Dacre, where the workshops are, we're very lucky. It's behind a medieval castle. It's a converted barns. So they just blend into the workshop. We took all our signage down saying the Cumbria Clock Company. And we let the people in the village did know you can't keep the secret in the village itself. But we told them we've got to keep this a secret. We don't want people coming here. And it was just brilliant because they became part of the security system. you know, and it was great. It wasn't quite like Dad's Army where we had a hay trailer parked in front of the door and rolled it out every day.
So around the clock volunteers, yeah. keep, you know, with a yes. yeah, with a bayonet.
But it's been brilliant from that point of view, the way that it has been kept a secret. I'm quite amazed that we haven't had anybody just walking up to the workshop saying, well, I say that, very, very, very few people walking up to the workshop and saying, can we, you know, I hear you got Big Ben. We did have somebody, you know, a group of ramblers looking through the window saying, we've been told if we look through this window, we can see the pendulum of Big Ben swinging. And I went to see them. I said, well, no, that's not Big Ben. That's from such and such a church. We do so many. Well, do you really think we would have Big Ben here? And off they went on their ramble again.
Wow. Well, if they're listening, they now know the truth of it. They now know the truth of it. And so is it, where is it now? It's all back in London. The reason you can talk about it now is because it's all back in London.
Yeah, there's nothing in Cumbria now. So we've taken it all back to the estate.
And when will we hear it bonging again?
Oh, that's hard. I mean, we're hoping for spring. It's hard to put a timescale on it because it is, even though it's so big, a precision instrument. Now, we transplanted the heart of the UK from London to Cumbria for 2 years. Now we're putting it back into the body. So, you know, we want to make sure we get it right. And I think, you know, if we said spring, I think we'll be about right with that. There's a lot of things to sort out. And nearly every component of the clock has been gone through by us and the Palace Clock team, and we're kind of fitting it all back into place and triple checking it working with everything. I mean, there is this frightening part that whenever you do a turret clock restoration, the only place you can fully test it is when it's in the tower.
Is anyone you've got it back there?
And
yeah.
So, yeah. And the worrying part is that there will be times when it will stop because when Lord Grimthorpe fitted it in 1859, there were stoppages because it's the only place you can test it. So I'm hoping the general public and everybody around the world will understand that there might be the odd stoppage, but we're there making it work. It's going to look spectacular. I mean, and we've become part of the history of that clock. And Cumbria now will be always linked to this worldwide icon.
Just one final thing, Keith. And actually, on the subject of your sort of part in history, it seems to be traditional that clockmakers, when they work on something, might put their signature, put their mark somewhere on the clock. When it's all back there in the tower, ringing again, has it got Keith Scobie Young somewhere on the clock?
I kind of, you know, clock graffiti is a really interesting thing. You know, we find a lot. I found one of John Vernon, who was one of those clockmakers who I was kind of an improver for when I went to London, and he told me the stories, and he's the one who rebuilt it. I won't put my name, scratch my name on it. I won't be part of the graffiti of the clock. I'm not saying there might not be something attached, or hidden. That is saying Keith Scobie-Youngs or Cumbria Clock Company or the members of the Clock Company Company, but it won't be graffiti on the mechanism itself. It's too important to do that.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. And you can listen via the Times Radio app. Catch me Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, live on Times Radio. And if you want to come on and play the hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? Email me your details, matt.chorley@times.radio. And we'll get you on very soon.